Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the evidence that Russia interfered with the 2016 election is mounting week by week and month by month, my guest today writes that evidence is also growing that this was not a one-time effort to help one candidate or hinder another, but part of a systematic effort to undermine democracy, both here in the United States and other Western democracies as well. The goal? To create capitalist autocracies, very similar to Russia under Vladimir Putin, or say, China under Xi Jinping. Malcolm Nance is a former military intelligence officer and a national security and counterterrorism analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. His previous book, The Plot to Hack America, was written in 2016 as Russian hacking became apparent in the intelligence community. His latest book examines the methodology used by Russian agents then and examines the why, obviously to end sanctions and assets frozen against top Russian officials and oligarchs affiliated with the Putin regime, but also to create something Nance calls an axis of autocracies. He sees Russian manipulation and the rise of alt-right parties in Central and Eastern Europe, encouraging movements ranging from Erdogan in Turkey to Brexit proponents in the UK and the National Front in France, as well as far-right movements here in the United States. His book is titled The Plot to Destroy Democracy, How Putin and His Spies Are Undermining America and Dismantling the West. It's published by Hatchett, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Malcolm Nance, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here.
Your previous book, The Plot to Hack America, sort of examined the effort to penetrate our electoral process almost in real time. Now, this new book, The Plot to Destroy Democracy, delves deeper into the Russian intelligence apparatus and the sort of the longer backstory of what happened. Why did you want to tell this particular story?
Well, when I wrote Plot to Hack America, it's like you said, I wrote that book in 5 weeks. And what it was an intelligence projection of all of the things which had to be in place in order for the Russians to work with the Trump team in order to get Donald Trump elected. And as you know, that came out about, what, 5-6 weeks before the election. And believe it or not, we had its greatest success in the 2 years after the election, because everything that I had written was validated by the CIA and the National Intelligence Community report. But that was just the start. As a matter of fact, my recommendations, some, many of which were carried out by the previous administration, those recommendations stopped just before the election. So there was a natural sequel that had to be written. And so to write that natural sequel, I had to go back deeper and further into the Russian active measure to elect Donald Trump president. And now, before people start asking, there was an activity, there was a Russian operation which did work to create an influence campaign to elect Donald Trump president. I'm not the only one saying that. The U.S. intelligence community's entire assessment of it was that. And, you know, I always get this, you know, oh, that's partisan. People believe everything I say about ISIS and Al-Qaeda in my previous career in counterterrorism. Intelligence professionals don't fudge. When we come to give you what we call ground truth, that's the truth. And so the Russians carried out this campaign. So in this next book, I needed to go deeper. Why did they carry out the campaign? How did they carry out the campaign? What were their strategic goals in doing that? How did they co-opt not just Trump and his campaign? They've co-opted major parts of the Republican Party who will not believe anyone's word that the Russians had anything to do in our campaign. On the other hand, the National Rifle Association was targeted very early by the Kremlin and American evangelicals. So there are chapters in all of them, as well as the alt-right, Steve Bannon's creation, which is essentially the weaponization of and conglomeration of the Ku Klux Klan, the neo-Nazis, and all white supremacists in the United States into one unifying movement. So Russia has its fingers on all of those. And the funny thing about it is, we have Americans who literally served in the armed forces through the Cold War and who saw all of these nefarious activities when they were carried out under the KGB, right, under the Soviets, but refuse to believe that now Russia has money and can afford BMWs and Mercedes-Benzes, that all of those activities simply disappeared. And those activities didn't. When the KGB fell, all they did was have the guy from maintenance come out, remove the letters KG, and replace it with FSB, right? And everyone went to work the next day. Paychecks didn't stop. And over the last 20 years, their budget to carry out the exact same influence activities to discredit and destroy Western and American democracy has increased into the billions of dollars as opposed to the millions.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was struck by is you write about the motivation of these agencies, and all that has gone is the communist versus capitalist rhetoric. It's still about breaking down democracies, making them look more like Russia in a way, more autocratic.
Well, in fact, Russia had an identity crisis when the Soviet Union collapsed. You might recall that within a year of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the communists tried to do a coup against Boris Yeltsin and tried to take back the government. And then over the years that followed, the question of what is a Russian? What is the Russian identity? And that's a question, by the way, that has existed for centuries. You know, Russia has always been struggling with whether they're of the East or whether they're of the West. You know, 75% of its people are in the European part of Russia, and 75% of its land is in Asia. And so this brought about there was actually a political philosophy called Eurasianism, where they struggled to create their own identity from the hybrids of Europe and Asia. And now there have been modern philosophers who have come up, like Alexander Dugin, who believe in a philosophy called Neo-Eurasianism, which requires that the poles of how the world has existed since the end of World War II, with the Atlantic Alliance and the United States exercising influence around the world disproportionately, and the European democracies practicing liberal democracy, those need to be done away with, and that the true poles in the world should center in Moscow, go through the European capitals, and then on to the United States. But the ideology that would underpin this recalibration of the world to a certain extent would be no longer an ideology of communism. It would be an ideology of capitalist autocracy. And it's much closer. People say, well, does Putin want to be, you know, Peter the Great? No, he doesn't want to be anything like Peter the Great. Peter the Great, you know, loved the West. He actually went and secretly worked in the West to understand their technology and shipbuilding in order to make Russia more like Western Europe. Russia today is more like Tsar Nicholas I, whose philosophy was autocracy, nationality, and orthodoxy in religion. And with Vladimir Putin, you can throw onto the top of that kleptocracy, right? The use of government to steal the resources. So that's what Russia is today, a nation that is also now fundamentally Christian conservative. And they have very, very hardline conservative attitudes, almost visceral hatred of gays. They hate what we see as diversity and liberalism in thought and philosophy. And they are sort of, it's like Stalin minus the communism, right? Mm. And let me just point something out. Vladimir Putin's father would know about that because Putin was a communist KGB officer until his late 40s. But his father was Stalin's cook. So, very interesting. So somewhere in his mind, I can't psychologically profile the man. But, you know, as much as they like having the benefits of the West, you know, of capitalism, the trappings, Russia itself is a very poor nation. It has a poor economy. The gross domestic income is about the same as Italy. We actually have more trade with Chile than we do with Russia. Mm-hmm. Actually, the United Arab Emirates, due to their natural gas and oil exports, have more trade with the United States than with Russia. So that gives Russia an incentive to want to put themselves back as a true superpower, not just essentially a trailer park with atomic bombs.
There's been a lot of speculation on what the true Russian aim was in interfering in our political process in 2016 and what seems to be ongoing towards 2018 election. And you've outlined one idea. The other is that this is simply an effort to repeal the Magnitsky Act, which puts sanctions on many of the leaders of the Russian government, and the Crimea sanctions, also, again, personal sanctions against the richest and powerful people in Russia. And it's an effort to repeal those sanctions. Do you think that is the ultimate aim, or this larger game that you're talking about?
No, there's a longer ball game here. I mean, this, you know, again, we are talking about the president of Russia is an ex-KGB officer and was the first director of the post-Soviet intelligence agency, the FSB, which created a state intelligence agency that still had the SVR, its clandestine service. But none of their strategic goals went away. How do you get your money back? Okay, your country that has liquidated every public asset that existed and sold it off for cash, and you got to keep all of those illicit funds that you stole by selling off airports, oil refineries, and nuclear power plants. Literally, just creating these guys would create a document at the state level, sell it to an investor, and privatize, you know, surface-to-surface ballistic missile, you know, production companies. And all of that cash is in your pocket, billions upon billions of dollars. The Russians hid all of that cash in the West in the form of real estate throughout Europe and the United States into, you know, physical assets. What did Dickens call it, right? Portable property. So things that you could actually handle or places that you could actually go to, like castles on Lake Cuomo or mansions in Palm Beach, Florida. That money could sit there and earn interest through the increase of the market, and then you could liquidate them in the future safely. That is what Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and previous presidents ended up sanctioning against Russia. Obama, particularly for the invasion of Crimea. We essentially took the money of the oligarchs who had made all of this illicit, dirty money through the liquidation of the Soviet Union, and we froze it so that their money is no good anywhere in the West. Those people are desperate, technically, to get their money back. And at this point, working with Putin and his belief that the United States would be a better partner if it was not a democracy, but an autocracy closer to Russia and closer to a strongman leader, the way that you see rising throughout the world. Erdogan in Turkey, Sisi in Egypt, Haftar in Eastern Libya, you know, all these characters, you know, and even Xi in China, who just made himself president for life.
Right.
These nations understand the way that money buys power, which is why Donald Trump, when he was elected president, was immediately feted in Saudi Arabia. Because for the first time, this was an American president who in their mind could be bought, who understood their problem of like getting a third or a fourth boat to fit inside a $70 million yacht, right? That is the oligarchy as it exists in this world. Obama was a true Republican, constitutional Republican. He believed in the fundamental justness and goodness of American democracy as raising up all people. People who run an oligarchy do not believe in that, okay? And going back to that Tsar Nicholas philosophy, right, of nationalism, autocracy, and oligarchy, you use religion to rule for a very small fraction of a fraction of the 1%, which at that time was a monarchy, right?
Right.
And you control people with religion and nationalism. But they got nothing, and it led to the October Revolution of 1917. But now you have a kleptocracy on top of that in modern Russia. And that kleptocracy understands how people think because they have the ability to use all the archives of the Soviet Union as led by a man who was a spy under the Soviet Union. And they understood you can change people's minds about their own form of government so long as you can distribute the right information in the right pattern and sequence. That was never successful for them until the rise of social media, in which any idea, no matter how crazy, could be injected into the bloodstream of political thought, and it would self-replicate through the equally crazy people who read it and transmit it out to the point where it could become normative, it could become mainstream. And the Russian intelligence apparatus had been building systems for decades in disinformation. They are the global masters of disinformation. For those of people who are of a certain age like us, we might recall that their paper, their newspaper, Pravda, meant the truth.
Right.
And every person in the world knew that the word Pravda meant you are reading lies. However, today they've created Russia Today, which is state-sponsored TV on par with CNN and Al Jazeera, which subtly lies. They hire Westerners, and they go out and they use disinformation in ways that you don't even know you're being disinformed. They use social media with entire agencies that craft that, you know, what we call meta-narratives. And these meta-narratives surround you and flood you with so much information that you start thinking it's your idea. So Donald Trump lives within one of those meta-narratives. He was flooded with Russian perspectives, especially when he went to Miss Universe in 2013 and had a two-hour secret meeting with the 12 richest oligarchs of Russia, including Vladimir Putin's personal representatives, and these people totaled as much as $200 billion in wealth. Donald Trump would pay attention to those people because they are of the base that he has always wanted, the acceptance of the global ultra elite. And so Russia, dangling that in front of him, found the autocrat who would transition the United States from democracy to autocracy.
My guest today is Malcolm Nance. He's a former military intelligence officer and national security and counterterrorism analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. His new book is titled The Plot to Destroy Democracy. One of the things that your book points out is this didn't start in 2015. It didn't start in even late 2014. This started right after the serious operations to influence American public opinion and the electoral process started right after Obama's second election, 2012, 2013.
Yeah.
Operation Grizzly Step, as it's termed by U.S. intelligence organizations. What is Operation Grizzly Step?
Well, Grizzly Step is a code name that was fabricated by the FBI and the CIA on the Russian intelligence operation that led to the election of Donald Trump. That's the official code name. If you go to the Director of National Intelligence's website and you download the report on Russian influence campaign, that is the mission name. And like all good spy agencies, we love having an operational name. My name for it was Operation Lucky 7. And that's just about the difference between my first book, Plot to Hack America, and the CIA's report. We came up with different code names. But that being said, everything else was exactly the same. Donald Trump decided to run definitively for president on the night of November 8th, 2012, the night that Barack Obama defeated Mitt Romney and was reelected president of the United States. And in a brilliant confession, in a Facebook post by Russia's version of Ted Turner, the owner of Channel One, the largest cable channel in Russia, a man by the name of Konstantin Rykov, on the day after Trump's election, he wrote all of this in his Facebook page, that Donald Trump had DM'd him, and they had communicated on that election night. Trump had said, why are we not marching on Washington against Barack Obama to get him out of office? And Rykov tweeted him and said, well, if you're planning on doing something about it, Russia is with you. Trump responded to that direct message with a photograph of him giving the thumbs up. The next week, Donald Trump registered Make America Great Again Political Action Committee. So Trump had been planning and had already started his run for presidency as a Republican the night of Barack Obama's reelection, and Russia had been in direct communication with him from that point onward. 1 year later, he would be in Russia for the Miss Universe pageant, and as I said earlier, he would be meeting with the top richest men of Russia, and when he would come out of that meeting, he would be spouting their ideology. The destruction of NATO, the demolishment of the European Union, how the Atlantic Alliance between Washington and the European capitals was dated and needed to be replaced with this alliance of autocracies, as I call it, an axis of autocracy. And if you look at Trump's tweets throughout 2014, he agrees with Vladimir Putin on everything. When Putin invades Crimea, a sovereign nation, and takes a province that has a majority Russian people, Trump comes out and tweets that Putin is a strong leader, unlike Barack Obama. He literally endorses the invasion of Crimea via Twitter. And he wouldn't announce that he was running president for another year, but if you read his 2014 Twitter feed, it's pretty obvious the man's running for president and that he supports Moscow's position on virtually everything.
And Grizzly Step was basically this multi-pronged intelligence influence campaign.
Operation.
Yeah, operation to infiltrate a number of organizations. You mentioned some of them earlier, the Republican Party, the NRA, the alt-right. And this was – so this is multi-pronged. And a number of agencies working on this.
You know, what's fascinating is I always get this question from detractors who go, hey, you're a Middle East counterterrorism guy. How is it you know anything about Russian intelligence? Well, I was a Middle East counterterrorism guy that started in the Cold War, okay? And from day one, when you get your top secret security clearance, all you are briefed on is Russian intelligence operations and how they will trap you and how they carry out operations against your allies. I worked in every country in the Middle East or against every country in the Middle East. I can tell you right now, the Russians were everywhere. Libya, Russian intelligence. Egypt, the Russians. Get off a ship in Port Said, the Russians would be there trying to recruit you. Operations against Syria, their intelligence agency run by the KGB. Saddam Hussein's Iraq, East German and Russian intelligence. For those people who have clearly forgotten the Cold War, right? The phrase, beware of the bear is everywhere. That was a day-to-day lifestyle for every person in U.S. intelligence. And I, of course, having to do Middle East operations, you would see joint operations between Egypt and Russia. And so when I saw the outline of what was going on in Grizzly Step, my first thought was, this is an old-school KGB-style operation. I haven't seen stuff like this since, you know, the Russians tried to influence Egyptian trade unionists back in the 70s. And, you know, this is old school stuff. But that's the problem. People thought that by eliminating the name KGB, the KGB's body of knowledge and corporate database went out the window, just disappeared from the, you know, from history. These people, especially when your country is led by a KGB officer, they're going to fall back to what worked. And what works was these old school systems and ways of influencing people revolutionized to the point where something which would have taken 2 or 3 years under the KGB could literally happen in a matter of minutes with a keystroke of a computer on social media. So, of course, Vladimir Putin took his shot. I mean, who wouldn't? You have the ability to choose a president of the United States who is open to you and, more importantly, who will get your money back that Barack Obama throws around the world.
Now, one of the things that people have been remarking about is we have seemingly, if you actually believe that Donald Trump is compromised by the Russians, and that's that we're at this point, we're still surmising it. Evidence seems to be growing, but we're still surmising that. Yet the government apparatus, the Magnitsky Act is still in place. The sanctions are still in place. We're actually putting additional sanctions in many ways. Our government seems to be operating in two minds.
It does. We have a bipolar government. And this is what really upsets me when I hear people say the deep state, all right? That's, you know, that's an X-Files phrase. They think that there are men sitting around in the basement smoking cigarettes and making the true decisions about the world. I mean, you know, conspiracy theorists who surmise that the Rothschilds and the George Soros are controlling everything. That's where you hear that ridiculousness. What you are seeing is democracy work. And from the time that George Washington appointed Alexander Hamilton the head of the Treasury and Jefferson Secretary of State, this government has worked by bureaus. So if you want your Social Security checks at the end of the month, or armed forces pay on the 1st and the 15th, or you need, you know, do an ecological study of, you know, bear habitats in Alaska, that is the government. And what Donald Trump fundamentally didn't understand was a constitutional republic, all right, a democracy, has guardrails that were written into it by our founding fathers. And Donald Trump is smashing against those guardrails, and the guardrails are holding. There are three branches of government, theoretically, all right, they're all independent. Donald Trump doesn't understand that. He doesn't respect it. Look, this is Dan Quayle territory, right? He was raised rich. He was put into schools where he never studied. He just got the degrees. And he really just doesn't know how to spell potato. Matter of fact, Donald Trump doesn't know how to spell a lot of things, starting with the word council. So these fundamental guardrails of how democracies work, how compromise and solutions and cooling down of your thoughts and consensus were precisely what the Founding Fathers designed it to do. And he does not like it. But, you know, Joe Scarborough at MSNBC wrote an op-ed about a year ago that I quote in the book, where he said, you know, the Founding Fathers always predicted that there would be a president that would come out and act like a tyrant or a king, like King George III, who we got our freedom from. But they never foresaw that a deliberative body like the House of Representatives or the Senate would become a rubber stamp for that tyrant. And it just doesn't work when you decide to go from a representative government to a Soviet-style Politburo, in which you just agree with whatever the dictator says. That's a banana republic. And I think it was John Cornyn, Republican senator, who said that the other day. We're getting into banana republic territory. And that's hard to argue with. Donald Trump is an authoritarian. He does not believe in the precepts of the presidency of the United States. He calls the White House a dump. Okay? And that's his words. That just does not work. And you can tell by the way that he does not hold the dignity of the office. He does not respect the office. He does not respect that he has to do things according to the laws of this nation. And when he won't, we're going to get a lesson as to whether the American experiment will hold. And I think that this November, if Donald Trump maintains a Republican majority in the House and the Senate, I think you will see American republicanism possibly break, finally, terminally.
One thing that has struck me, and I wanted to get your opinion about this when I heard about this last month, Russia has dumped 84% of its U.S. Treasury debt, and they've been buying gold. What should we make of this?
You know, really, I think you should grab Paul Krugman and see if you can get it. That requires a Nobel Prize-winning economist. However, anything which appears extraordinary, which is what this is, which is getting U.S. debt out of your hands, means that you have no confidence in what will follow in the U.S. system. And that leads me to wonder, look, I'm an old spy. My job was to give intentions and warnings about enemy activity, whether it's a small boat 10 miles away or it's a nation state about to collapse. So I watch for what we call, you know, significant intelligence indicators. That economically is a significant intelligence indicator. That feels more like what we would expect to see when an embassy is about to close, right? And you see trash barrels being rolled out back and everything set on fire. So, you know, when you do an emergency destruct, that would lead me to believe that they do not want their capital in the United States. However, there is so much oligarch money here that they wouldn't abandon it. You're talking quite possibly hundreds of billions of dollars that has been invested in the United States.
Well, a lot of it's in property, right?
Right. And so
you can't take that with you.
No, you can't take it with you, but you can certainly sell it once the sanctions are lifted. And then if you look at the way Senator Rand Paul has been talking as sort of the courier for Donald Trump to Vladimir Putin and the Russian Duma, they're talking about lifting sanctions now. Now, whether the rest of our representative government will go along with that, I don't know. But the Russians apparently are preparing for something, and quite possibly to destabilize the American economy.
Malcolm Nance, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Malcolm Nance is a former U.S. intelligence officer and a national security and counterterrorism analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. His book is titled The Plot to Destroy Democracy. It's published by Hatchett. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.